The Classic Comics Forum podcast presents issue number 11, Green Arrow by Mike Grell, part 2. Welcome back to the Classic Comics Forum podcast. As always, I'm your host, Scott Harris, and in today's episode, I'll be picking up with part 2 of my look at Mike Grell's influential and controversial run on Green Arrow. In the last episode, I started by taking a look at the Longbow Hunters, numbers 1 through 3, and issues 1 through 8 of the ongoing series. In today's episode, I'll be picking up where I left off, starting with issue 9, and I'll be running through issue 80, Mike Grell's last issue, and I'll also be discussing the Green Arrow annuals, miniseries, crossovers, and some of the plans that Grell had for the book before he was unceremoniously dumped from the title. So I hope you enjoy, and we're going to jump right into it, starting with issue number 9. Enjoy. So then we get a 4-issue Shadow story, issues 9 to 12, and this is going to begin an annual tradition where when Oliver Queen is celebrating his birthday, we get a 4-issue Shadow storyline. This is going to be an annual event for a while, and then later on they'll skip a couple years before coming back. This is a really key story. We get more Shadow's origin. Ollie gets roped into this plot where he tracks down Shadow and she shoots him. She doesn't kill him. She realizes right at the last second who he is, and she manages to flinch enough so that the arrow doesn't kill him, but it severely injures him, and he's basically out of it for a couple weeks. And, you know, as part of the storyline, the stuff with the money that he got gets from the CIA, that plot line gets tied up. But more importantly here is the fact that while Ollie is unconscious, Shadow basically rapes him. He's delirious. He doesn't recognize Shadow. He doesn't know where he is. He thinks that Dinah is taking care of him. And so Shadow basically has sex with him while he is in this state of delirium, and he thinks he's having sex with Dinah. He's like fading in and out of consciousness and hallucinating. And of course, this is going to become very important next time we see Shadow in issues 21, which we'll get to in just a minute. Now, it's important to note also that this is not really made explicit. It takes place in like a fever sequence from Ollie's point of view, so you're not really sure what's going on. It's not until later appearances by Shadow that we get the full story, we find out what actually happened. The other important thing that happens in this story is we start to get into the reason why Green Arrow and Shadow are drawn to each other. It has to do with their shared experience of the bow. There's a contrast between Shadow's Eastern philosophies, where she's sort of shooting with her heart, and Ollie's Eastern sort of more technical and mechanical style. They're sort of learning from each other. We get into this a lot more much later on in conversations between Shadow and Dinah about how they both sort of have only half of Ollie's soul. So it's pretty interesting. But before we get that, we have a stretch here, issues 13 to 20, where there's all these hot button issues, a lot of real world issues, particularly issues 17 to 18. There's a story, it's about prostitution and almost in a way sort of the white slavery trade. It's about girls sort of being forced into a life of prostitution and then just being sold like slaves. And it's about this guy who's a Canadian Mountie who this girl had come to him for help, and he basically didn't help her, and she got sold across the border into the U.S., and she gets killed in this story, and she is crucified. So there's this like full-page spread where she's been tortured and mutilated and crucified. And this was a really controversial issue. It was actually featured in an issue of Time magazine talking about the new wave of adult, grittier comics that DC in particular was putting out at the time. It's something I remember reading. This is before I had started reading Green Arrow, but I remember reading about this issue in Time magazine. And during this run of issues, the letter column really starts developing because Grell is putting out all these politically themed issues that are touching on, again, all sorts of things from gay rights to the CIA to, you know, you name it. And so the letter column develops into this really interesting forum where people are writing these long sort of philosophical letters debating with each other about the different topics that Grell is bringing up. And for me, I think it's great. And I think it's one of the best letter columns that I've ever read is the Green Arrow letter column from this time period. And I think it's a perfect example of the usefulness of letter columns. You know, these days, very few comics have letter columns. There are a few, like Squirrel Girl has a letter column, but most comics don't have letter columns. And the excuse that I've read is that, you know, the fans on the internet can react instantly to comics and they can talk to each other about it on the internet so that the letter column doesn't really serve a purpose. But I don't think that's true. You know, the letter column for Green Arrow points out a way that this discussion can, between fans, can be a more formalized extension of the comic itself. You know, Grell's bringing up these issues, and then, you know, for the characters, the next issue they move on to the next story. But the stuff he's bringing up, these important societal concerns, the debates rage on for months and months in the letter column, and they become part of the conversation about Green Arrow, the series, about Green Arrow, the character, about what it means to be a fan of these characters. It provides a forum for debate that talking to random people on the internet does not. Because, you know, if one of these comics came out now and I went online and posted the most insightful breakdown of the comic that anyone could ever possibly do, that would be great for the handful of people that were on that particular forum and read it. But it wouldn't be read by anybody else. You know, it wouldn't be read by the fan base at large. Whereas, you know, the 100,000 people who are reading Green Arrow got to see this debate happen. Now, of course, they could choose not to read it, and the editors can choose which letters to publish. But I think it's too bad that we've lost letter columns, because I think they provide a real service to fans and to creators. There's a lot to be said for a good letter column. So in this issue, a couple more interesting things happen. Dan Jurgens ends up joining the series, and we'll talk about him more in a little bit. And there's a two-issue arc where Hal Jordan shows up, and it's during a phase where, after the prostitution storyline, Ollie gets super depressed, and he drinks himself into a stupor, and Hal shows up to basically smack some sense into him and help him sober up. What's interesting is that he only shows up as Hal Jordan. Keeping with the style of the series, there's no Green Lantern talk. There's no superhero stuff. He doesn't use the ring. I think it's mentioned because they end up going camping. And so they have a truck and they don't fly out there. I think Aldi mentions it. But that's pretty much it. It was nice to see Hal Jordan in the series. It was a good sort of reminder of the relationship they had. He doesn't appear again in the series, which is kind of too bad. Anyway, after that, we get the next Shadow storyline. So at this point, I believe Ollie is celebrating his 45th birthday at the beginning of this story. We get the annual four-part Shadow crossover. The storyline is very simple. It's a political intrigue. It doesn't really matter. The important part is that we're introduced to Shadow's newborn son. And at the end of this story, the reader learns that the child is Oliver's child, but he doesn't know it. And what's particularly interesting to me as a fan of Mike Grell and of Warlord, specifically one of my favorite titles, is there's a real clear parallel between the story of Ollie, a Shadow, and their child, and the story in Warlord of Warlord, Tara, and their son Joshua. So for those who haven't read Warlord, basically the story is in Warlord number 15, Tara gives birth to their son Joshua. He's kidnapped by their archenemy Deimos, and a few issues later, Deimos basically clones Joshua, and he rapidly ages the clone into adulthood, and Warlord fights him and kills him, and he thinks that he's killed the son. He doesn't know that his son's been cloned. And so there's this ongoing subplot for the next 30 years of Warlord stories where he doesn't know that he has a son, and his son is sort of doesn't really know at first that Warlord is father. He eventually finds out. There's a lot of sort of near misses and a lot of personal angst on the part of Warlord about the loss of his son. And this is paralleled in the pages of Green Arrow, where we have a situation where Ollie really wants to be a father. He wants a son. He doesn't know that he has a son. And so the not having children really bothers him. It really weighs down on him. And yet there's also this ongoing subplot for several years in the background where the reader knows that he has a son. The characters, other than Ollie, as we'll see, eventually find out that he has a son. But they never end up connecting. And I wonder exactly what's going on with Grell here. I don't think it's any coincidence that they have the same thematic storyline with the father and son dynamic of a father who wants a son and doesn't have it, and a son who grows up without a father, and the two of them never really being able to connect. I think it's pretty obvious that this is a story that's very important to Mike Grell. But exactly why, I'm not sure. This is one instance where I haven't really been able to find any discussion from Grell in interviews about it. It's something that I'd personally be very curious to find the answer to. Now, after the storyline, we get some more kind of change of pace issues. And the next storyline, a little two-parter in issues 25 and 26, has a very strange change of pace where we get Ollie takes this trip to Europe, and we get this mix of like Celtic mysticism in this storyline. It really feels completely out of place compared to the tone of the rest of the series. There are some thematic things that come up here that will end up becoming important later down the road. A lot of the story is sort of about the Green Man and the Celts' connection to the Earth. And we're going to see later on that stories about nature and the environment and like man's connection to nature and the environment are going to become important thematically. They're subjects that Grell had touched upon earlier in John Sable, and he would later touch upon in Shaman's Tears. So this is another type of story that's thematically important to Grell, but the manner of delivering it is very atypical for this series, where normally everything is so realistic. This, it's an interesting change of pace. It doesn't really quite work for me. One thing that seems really out of place in this story is that at the end of issue 25, there's just a completely random cameo by John Constantine. He doesn't do anything in this story. He's just not like casting magic or whatever. So it's not, I guess, that weird, but just having him pop up randomly kind of goes against the style that Grell has, where there aren't really many other characters from the extended DC universe in the story. But Constantine's appearance, along with Hal Jordan's appearance in issues 19 and 20, do bring up sort of an interesting conundrum. At one point in an interview, Grell said that DC basically has kind of three universes: Earth 1, Earth 2, and Earth Grell. And we're definitely in Earth Grell for this series, where Grell is not really paying any attention to continuity in other series. He just completely ignores it and does his own thing. And that leads to some weird hiccups in other titles. Most importantly, in Justice League, we have a situation where Black Canary had been one of the main characters in the relaunched Justice League when it started at the beginning of 1987. But after the events of Longbow Hunters, they had to just abruptly write her out of the series in order to have the events of Justice League fit in with what was going on in the pages of Green Arrow. This caused a lot of confusion for fans. I've mentioned how great the letter column is. The flip side of the letter column is there are a lot of letters from fans that are getting confused and kind of bent out of shape about Grell playing fast and loose with DC continuity, where they're trying to figure out how these stories fit in with DC continuity. Like, why didn't Black Canary use her canary cry to free herself? Grell's answer is basically he's writing a world where people don't have superpowers, so he just decided to completely ignore the fact that she even has a canary cry. And he's like, that's a problem for someone else to figure out. He couldn't have cared less. Now, eventually, other writers did figure it out, sort of a little bit backwards. They ended up basically saying that when she was tortured, she lost her canary cry, and she would later get it back after Grell left the series. But issues like that continued to crop up. One of the strangest things really about the title, just from a meta perspective, is that while the main series is going on and not interacting with anything else in the DC universe, the annuals are still parts of major DC superhero crossover events, and most of them are not written by Mike Grell. The first couple are written by Denny O'Neill. They have crossovers with The Question. There's a crossover later on in the Eclipso event. I forget what the event was called, but it sucked, so who cares? But there's one where Black Canary gets possessed by the spirit of Eclipso, and those stories really are jarring when you read them in conjunction with the main series because they just tonally don't make any sense. So anyway, after that story, we get one of my favorite little stories in this run, because again, I'm a huge fan of Warlord. In issues 27 and 28, Travis Morgan, the Warlord, shows up, and Grell gets, basically the whole first part of the series is Travis Morgan is just wandering around the world. He's come out of Skartaris to sort of see what's going on Earth, and he happens to end up in Seattle, and because Grell's design for Warlord is so similar to the design for Green Arrow with the goatee and everything, there's this case of mistaken identity where all of Green Arrow's enemies mistake Travis Morgan for Oliver Queen. They all attack the Warlord. And so at the end of the issue, he tracks down Ollie and just punches him in the grill because he's so pissed off about everyone trying to kill him. And then issue 28, basically all of Green Arrow's enemies come to Sherwood Floors to kill Ollie, and they quickly discover they've made a terrible mistake because the Warlord basically just kills all of them. I mean, Ollie and Dinah defend their home too. There's a cool scene where a guy tries to run over Travis Morgan in a car, and he destroys the car using his magic sword. It's pretty cool. I'm a big fan of that story, and it was really cool to have Grell back working with Warlord, but also the artist for this issue is Dan Jurgens, who was sort of the primary creator on Warlord after Grell left the series. So it was really cool, like, reunion of the top Warlord creators working with the character again. So after that, we get issues 29 and 30. This is another environmental parable. It's basically the story of the Exxon Valdez, which was relatively current at the time. And it's just a take on that. It starts getting us again more into Grell's feelings about nature and the environment and man's connection to and responsibility to nature. So it's interesting from that respect, but otherwise, you know, it's just okay. But after that story, we get into like what's really almost the meat of the entire Grell run, because we have a storyline that starts in issue 31 and doesn't really end until issue 50. Now, there are several sub-stories that take place in smaller arcs within this, but the narrative that begins in issue 31 really carries through until the issue 50, and I think this is, in some ways, the best part of the series. So the first part is a four-issue arc that really shows how Grell was playing the long game with this series. As I mentioned, one of the counters to the criticism of his use of Dinah in Longbow Hunters number 2 is the fact that this was not just a gimmick. It was something that would drive the character development for both her and Ollie for years worth of stories to come. That all pays off here in issues 31 to 34. At the beginning of the story, we get a tale that's basically a mirror image of the events of the first two issues of Longbow Hunters. Ollie's investigating some sort of drug deal. He gets captured and is basically almost tortured to death. Dinah ends up saving him. She shows up, breaks him free, and it brings the characters sort of full circle. Their roles are completely reversed at this point, where he was the one that was a helpless victim of violence. He's left with a lot of emotional issues, and just as she was, a part of it is the feeling of helplessness that she had to save him, that she saw him in that position. So he ends up dealing with a lot of stuff, and it also gives him a strong insight into what she was going through at the time, how she felt. Conversely, it gives her a different insight into how he was feeling about things. And after these events, she decides that she does want to have children with him. If you remember back in at the beginning of the series, he had really wanted to have children, and she said, no, what we do is too dangerous. But after these events, she comes to him and says, you know, I want to have some permanent piece of you. I thought I'd lost you, and I want to do something here so that, you know, no matter what happens to us, some piece of our relationship, our love will continue on. So they decide to have children. However, after trying for a little while, Dinah discovers that she can't have children. And it's very tastefully done. She basically just says there's not going to be a child. There's no explanation given. There's no details. It's just a scene where the two of them are grieving for this lost child that they wanted to have. The other thing that comes back to the roost from the beginning of the series is that the people that capture Ollie and torture him are the drug dealers who were involved in that story in issues 5 and 6, where the gangs were attacking gay couples as a gang initiation. And at the end of that story, Ollie had promised the drug dealer that he was going to at some point take him down. Well, that happens at the end of this story, and it happens not at the hands of Ollie. He's involved in capturing him, but it's actually Eddie Fires, who just straight up shoots the drug kingpin in the face, because that's just how he rolls. Now, if Eddie Fires is back in the game, then you know something big is about to go down. And what ends up happening is he spins Ollie the story that he is working for the government and he needs Ollie's help for this sort of black ops mission in the Panama Canal. So Ollie goes down. It turns out that he's been duped. He's been set up as a fall guy. What he thought he was doing one thing, but what he actually ended up doing was planting a bomb on a ship that blows up. And it causes this international incident. And the government comes and arrests Ollie for treason. And, you know, Ollie has been framed. Sort of. He actually did do what they're accusing him of, but he was used as sort of a bigger pawn in the game. And as the storyline goes along, Ollie ends up going rogue. He is sort of allowed to break free because it's a setup, a further part of a setup where they let him go so that they can then kill him. So his side of the story will never come out. But that, of course, is not what ends up happening. It turns out that, like, the government, the whole thing was a government setup. Just they had X that they wanted to do. They needed to have a really convenient fall guy for it, and they decided to use Ollie to set things up. And the result is that Ollie goes after Eddie Fires. They end up teaming up sort of at the end because Fires is also, they're trying to eliminate him as a loose end. And Ollie finally gets his name cleared. He gets a recording of the people in the CIA saying, you know, that he was innocent and that he was just a fall guy. And they go to the press with this, but the president basically steps up and apologizes before he can go live with it. And so, for all intents and purposes, the rest of the country just sort of doesn't care. But Ollie is left really angry and disillusioned with the government. He's really pissed off about the way he was treated. They used his political idealism and his patriotism against him. And so he ends up, in issue 39, he gets a meeting with the president where he basically tells the president to just stuff it. And he decides to go off the grid and he needs to sort of discover himself. So at the end of issue 39, he leaves Seattle and he leaves Dinah and he goes on this soul searching mission. Now, a couple of things I want to mention real quick about this arc before we get into his soul searching is that this is the next annual Shadow arc from issues 35 to 39. Dinah goes to Shadow and says, you know, Ollie's in trouble. He needs your help. I can't help him. The government's watching everything I do. I need someone outside the system. Dinah at this point discovers that Shadow's child is Ollie's son. Shadow explains to her that Ollie was unconscious and delirious and thought he was sleeping with Dinah. Dinah does not necessarily buy this as a valid excuse for him having a child with someone else, especially coming just like one issue after she discovers that she can't have children. So there's a lot of like really intense emotional drama and development going on with the characters here. Another key thing that happens during this story is that while Ali is on the run, he goes into the Seattle underground, hides among the homeless population, and he meets a homeless girl by the name of Marianne. She helps him out, and then at the end of the storyline, he gives her some of his money that he had left over from, forget if it was the stuff he got at the end of Longbow Hunters number 3 or if it was part of his payment for this mission, but he gives her like enough money to get a stake in restarting her life up, and Dinah gives her a job at Sherwood Florist. So that brings us up to this sort of soul-searching storyline. That takes the next 10 issues to go through, or 11 issues, because he doesn't return to Seattle until issue 50. And these issues are pretty interesting. Issue 40 is like a pure Mike Grell issue. It's an issue where he did all the art as well as the writing, and it's sort of a shamanistic fever dream. It's very reminiscent of his later work in Shaman's Tears. A lot of, drawings of trees and wolves and Native Americans. And it's sort of like a tone poem as Ollie goes off into the wilderness to wash away the stench of civilization that's corrupted his soul. Following this, we do get some interesting thematic stories here. He gets involved in this gun-running plot where people are funneling money and guns to the Irish Republican Army. At this time, the troubles between the IRA and the British government in Northern Ireland were still ongoing. So this was still sort of a current hot button issue. And it's interesting because this is sort of during this section, we're going to see this again in issues 46 to 49, where he goes to Africa and the government there hires him to help him stop poachers. Is we see situations where Ollie is trying to discover sort of what his new morality is now that it's sort of disconnected from his vision of American government and the American dream and the American system of justice. And it's contrasted with these political situations going on in other countries where there are other codes of morality, where there's people who believe they're doing the right thing, but are using different means to do it, such as the Irish Republican Army or the poachers are destroying the wildlife population, but they're also, a lot of them are sort of poor farmers who are trying to make money to feed their families. And there's a thing where they're able to escape across the border into a neighboring country in order to escape justice. And Ollie, being sort of a vigilante free agent, he is free to ignore the rules of the country and follow them across the border. So there's a lot of that going on in here where Ollie is sort of put in situations where are mirrors to the events that he went through that allow him to discover new things about himself. Another story that takes place in issues 44 and 45 has a situation where he ends up staying, I think it's in Wales, I'm not sure, with this family, and there's sort of this, it's sort of like a land grab storyline where there's a family that doesn't want to move, and there's like an evil rancher or whatever the hell he's doing that's trying to force him off his land. It's sort of that classic story. And the dad is refusing to pay, and he's sort of a dreamer, and it's like there's a son who sort of looks up to Ollie more. Ollie is sort of like a surrogate dad figure because he's like a cool guy. There even a couple of times seems to be a hint of sexual tension between Ollie and the wife and mother in this family. So, but by the end of the issue, the dad sort of proved himself to his wife and his child, and they've sort of like realize, hey, dad's really awesome. And Ollie gets, again, sort of another look at this father-son dynamic that keeps cropping up in the book in different ways. So it's an interesting set of stories in terms of the character work being done. The character work here it's actually kind of subtle because it plays out over such a long period of time. You really have to sort of study it to see what Grell is doing, but it's definitely there. While this is all happening, back in Seattle, Dinah's basically twiddling her thumbs, and Marianne is like, why are you, you know, waiting around for this guy? He's been gone for months. He doesn't, you know, he's kind of a jerk. So you should go out and enjoy yourself. And Dinah does have this opportunity because a new character shows up, a cop, a police officer by the name of Kaz, who helps her with a case or vice versa. And he is romantically interested in her. He's asking her out for dates, and she's like, no, no. But finally, in issue 50, she agrees to go on a date with Kaz. And this sort of kicks off a story that runs for the next three issues. Issue 50 is basically she and Kaz are up in the Space Needle, and it gets taken over by terrorists who are going to kill everybody. And Ollie sees it on the news. He's in an airport in Africa. And the terrorists have given like a 24-hour deadline, so he has enough time to get to Seattle and sort of break into the Space Needle and help save everybody, including Dinah, and interrupt her date with Kaz. Over the next couple issues, we see the story with Kaz, where basically when he was younger, he made a poor choice and he's being blackmailed ever since. But he's a good guy, so he goes vigilante and he hunts down and sort of kills the criminals who have been blackmailing him. And Dinah and Ollie are trying to stop him. And it's pretty interesting because Kaz is basically, in this story, we see him as a mirror of Ollie himself. What he's doing in the story is no worse than anything that Ollie has done over the course of this series. He makes a lot of the same decisions, or the same type of decisions that Ollie makes when he decides to hunt down and kill some of these criminals. It's just, things went a little sideways for him in the process, and at the end of the story, Kaz feels like he's betrayed his own principles, and he kills himself. So I find it to be a very interesting story. You know, Ollie and Dinah, I don't want to say they're passing judgment on Kaz, but they're kind of like, you know, you're crossing the line, you can't do this, you're going against the law, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, but Ollie's done all the same things. He's all done all the same things, and I think that's kind of the point of this story, is Kaz is a mirror image of Ollie, just like the stories in issues 40 to 49 were sort of mirroring the events so that Ollie could get a different idea of himself. Kaz is a character who is a mirror image of Ollie so that we as readers can see how those character changes have actually affected Ollie over the first 50 issues. From issues 1 to 50, Ollie's a different character. From the point where he first decided to kill the villain in issue 2 of Longbow Hunters to this storyline, he comes back from his trip knowing who he is. He's comfortable with being a killer, with being a vigilante killer, being outside the law, being his own law, and not in like a angry, vengeful way, but he's sort of, after the events of being used as a fall guy by the government, he no longer trusts the authorities. He's decided that he needs to be his own moral authority. And so he's comfortable with making these decisions, whereas Kaz is not. Kaz is a cop. He sees himself as being inside the law, and so he sees everything he does as a betrayal of himself. So he can't deal with it, so he kills himself. So he's a really interesting image of Ollie without Ollie's coping mechanisms. Is Ollie gone wrong? And we get another version of this in the next story arc. So in the next arc, Eddie Fires comes back. And the plot's kind of irrelevant. The important part is, in here we really see that Fires is Ollie, only without the moral compass. So in the last story, we get Kaz, who's Ollie, but with a different moral compass, where he still feels like law and order. He feels like there's a system, like he's the good guy, and so he can't handle the fact that he is not living up to himself. Fires is the opposite. He's the other extreme. He's the guy that now no longer has any moral code. He's sort of a warning for what Ollie could become if Ollie keeps down this path. Because for Fires, there's really no right or wrong. There's no good or evil. There's just what he decides to do. And as we're going to see later on, the very last story that Grell does is an Eddie Fire story in issue 80. And by the time we get to that point, Ollie has progressed to where Fire's a guy who is completely amoral and has set him up to get killed more than once and is just sort of like a murderer for hire. Fire's and Ollie, by the end of Grell's run, have become friends and partners. They're working together, and it's kind of the theme of the second half of Grell's run after issue 50 is Ollie's sort of slide. Like in the first issue, you know, in that second issue of Longbow Hunters where he killed the guy, he crossed a line he could never uncross. But it really feels like after issue 50, he's crossed a different sort of less obvious but just as important line where he's now comfortable with the line that he crossed before. He spent 50 issues sort of grappling with the new person that he is, and now he's sort of on a downward slide. You know, he now that he's comfortable with it, how far is he willing to go? That's really made explicit in the next storyline. It ties up some more loose ends from the beginning of the series, where right in Longbow Hunters, there was the first guy that Ollie was tracking down was a guy who was a serial killer who was killing prostitutes. The continuity here is a little confusing, but essentially in that story, Ollie tells the cops, hey, you've arrested the wrong guy. The guy that you just arrested for that series of killings is just a copycat killer. And the cops were like, you know what? Whatever. In this story, issue 55 and 56, the real killer is revealed, and it's someone that the Lieutenant Cameron, who is the police guy who shows up in all these stories involving the police, is someone that he's been trying to nail for a long time, and he basically couldn't get evidence. So they knew that he killed some people, but they couldn't get the evidence to prove it. But they had enough circumstantial evidence to nail him with a murder charge for a completely unrelated murder that he didn't actually do. And he gets out of prison in this story, and he goes to get his revenge. And Ollie basically offers his services and is like, you got a situation here where you're going to have to go outside the law to do it, so I will hunt down and kill this guy. And he's just sort of like, he's fine with it now. We see this sort of thing again in issues 59 and 60, where Ollie takes on a case, and similar in issue 55 and 56, where he tells the Lieutenant Cameron, hey, I'm your guy, I will do this, you shouldn't do this because you're the police guy, but I'm not, so I will take this on. In issues 59 and 60, he does something very similar where there's someone that's looking for vengeance, and he says, you know, let me do it, because he knows what that experience will do to the person's soul, and he takes the burden on himself because he's sort of already worked through it. It's a different kind of heroism where he is trying to protect people from the consequences of their actions by taking the action himself. And it's interesting because this is actually one of the big issues that Dinah had with him in Longbow Hunters, is that she never had the chance to do it for herself because he took that opportunity away from her by killing those people. Well, now he's doing this intentionally as a way to protect not just the people he loves like Dinah, but also just strangers. He's like, don't do this. I will do it. I will kill them for it. Issue 61 to 62, we get a story that is really out of place. It feels like it would have been perfectly fit in the original Green Lantern Green Arrow series from 1970, where it's like an anti-war sort of protest thing. These stories by this point, they actually feel like Grell is kind of running out of gas. Yes, he's doing some interesting things with where the stories are highlighting different aspects of Ollie's character. But in terms of the actual stories, whereas early on in the run, we had lots of really hot-button, controversial, interesting, and provocative stories, which also had this character development, these are starting to feel a little bit tired at this point. And that continues in issues 63 to 66, where we get the next Shadow storyline. Now, there was a year that was skipped in the annual Shadow crossovers while Ollie was traveling around the world. I guess she just couldn't find him for their annual team-up. But she shows up here, issues 63 to 66, and honestly, it's kind of boring. Up to this point, the Shadow issues have been kind of the highlight in terms of the action and driving the overall arc of the character. But this time around, it's just the tired old man is the most dangerous game story where this rich a-hole captures Ollie and Shadow and puts them on an island and tries to hunt them down. It's, you know, it's just not that interesting. And by the end of this, at issue 66, it really just kind of feels like Grell is running out of steam a little bit. Doesn't feel like he has much to say anymore. There's still things he might have to say about Ollie as a character, but he doesn't have, he said everything else, I guess, that he was going to say. And So the series starts to feel like it's playing out the string a little bit. Issues 67 to 74, there's really not that much of interest in them. Marianne suddenly pops up as an important supporting character again. She's been in the background a little bit for the last 30 issues. But here she starts coming back into play. We get some stuff from her point of view, and she starts to hint at having some romantic feelings towards Ollie. You remember she'd only met him a couple times early on in around issue 38, and then she was working for Dinah for a year, and during that time she was, like, you know, urging Dinah to start dating other people because Ollie just seemed like a loser at this point. However, now that he's back and around and, you know, in the game, she seems to be falling for him a little bit. These issues also introduce kind of an interesting concept for Green Arrow. He gets involved through Marianne again with sort of the underground homeless community, and we meet this group of different homeless people who have sort of, I don't want to say different abilities, but there's one guy who's really huge and strong, but is also like a scholar. There's a guy who is a Vietnam vet with some mental health issues, but he's got like a pair of like wild dogs that he's tamed, and there's a couple other people in the group. They basically become Ollie's version of the Merry Men. I find this to be sort of an interesting, like, I don't want to say an overdue idea, but it kind of seems obvious when you think about it. They work as Ollie's eyes and ears throughout Seattle, picking up leads and helping him with missions during this period of issues 67 to 74. They work on cases with him. I can't say that most of them are particularly interesting. Jefferson Two Dogs, the guy I mentioned who was a Vietnam vet, he's the most interesting of these characters, I think. He gets a spotlight issue in 74, which is basically about an evil psychiatrist using hypnotism to take advantage of his post-traumatic stress disorder to have him kill people. I really, really dislike this issue. I have problems in general with the sort of media cliche of the sinister psychiatrists. And I know that in the last podcast I talked about how much I like Dr. Faustus, but he's an exception that proves the rule. I just didn't like this issue at all. It made mental health professionals seem kind of manipulative and sinister, and I just didn't like the way it handled the post-traumatic stress disorder that Jefferson Two Dogs have. I just really didn't like it. Now, whether or not Jefferson Two Dogs and the rest of Green Arrow's Merry Men would have developed into more interesting cast members is something we'll never really find out, because after the events of issue 75, we don't really see them again. Issue 75 is kind of a watermark issue. A lot of important things happen. In a way, it's basically the end of the Grell run, although he continued writing it through issue 80. The plot's a little complicated. We get the return of one of the villainous CIA jerks from the first few issues. He actually appeared in Longbow Hunters number 3. He was the guy that had Eddie Fires working for him and gave Ollie the bag of laundered money. And in the first Shadow arc in issues 9 to 12, he was the bad guy in that, and he got hauled off to prison. But he's escaped, and he's back working with the Yakuza, and there's this complicated scheme that involves Roy Harper. Yes, it's the first time Roy Harper has made an appearance in the series, and I find his appearance in here to be very interesting. So much of the series is about fathers and sons, Ollie's longing to be a father, relationships between parents and children, and yet there's really been no mention of Roy Harper throughout the series. That gets rectified in this issue, where Roy Harper has been brainwashed by the Yakuza, and we end up with this convergence of all of the supporting characters in the Green Arrow series. Most of them show up to be part of this birthday party for Ollie that Dinah's throwing. And at the birthday party, Marianne decides to act on her infatuation with Ollie and kisses him. And of course, Dinah walks in and sees them kissing. And she's kind of more of an adult than either Ollie or Marianne. So she's like, you know, we're going to deal with this later, because right now we've got bigger fish to fry. Namely, the fact that right then, Roy Harper smashes through the window and tries to kill Ollie. Turns out, again, he's been brainwashed by the Yakuza, and they have his daughter that they're holding hostage. Shadow shows up to help because, of course, the Yakas are involved. And basically there's this team up where Dinah and Shadow and Ollie save Roy's daughter, and they end the Yakuza / CIA a-hole threat for good. The next few issues kind of deal with the fallout of this. In the next issue, Dinah is feeling super betrayed because she has been betrayed both by Ollie, but also by Marianne, who she took into her home, basically, gave her a job, treated her, like a friend, and even, I would say, like a daughter for years at this point. And so, basically, two of the closest people in her life have totally betrayed Dinah. Marianne ends up leaving, and so does Ollie. And Ollie, he ends up following Marianne down to their little subterranean hut. And there's a scene here, I think it's in issue 76, where Ollie's like, you know, there must be something there between us or something wrong in my relationship with Dinah. Otherwise, I wouldn't have, you know, felt the attraction to kiss you. I can't stand that. That sort of thought process really bugs me because it's kind of absolving himself of the blame in a way. He's like, well, you know, it's okay that I acted like an asshole because I wouldn't have acted like an asshole if things were right in my relationship. That's just not the case, man. Even if things aren't right in the relationship, you can choose how you're going to respond to it. You don't have to act like an asshole. So I think that's a complete cop-out to justify his behavior. He ends up sleeping with Marianne. He's like, you know, basically like, let's explore what this is. And what this is basically him getting really horny for someone that's less than half his age. That's it. Because the next day, Marianne's like, great, we can have a relationship now. I love you. And he's like, no, I pretty much just wanted to bang you. I got to think about some shit. And then he leaves. And that leads into a 4-issue arc where he teams up with Eddie Fires. The details aren't that important. They end up infiltrating this like survivalist camp where people go to get trained, get like military training so they can join a militia in Montana or something. Only it's actually like there's some sort of connection with the Russians or something. And there's a guy there that they're specifically trying to hunt down who's being smuggled like through there by the CIA into Canada or something. You know what? It really doesn't matter. The important part of this last arc is, as I mentioned earlier, where Ollie has slid so far now that he and Fires are actually friends and partners. And Ollie has sort of almost completed his descent where he's lost his own moral compass to the point where Eddie Fires actually makes sense to him. And then that's it. Grell is unceremoniously kicked off the book with issue 80, so it was a huge, extremely jarring transition for fans, because in the next issue, Ollie's back in Seattle, and all of a sudden, a supervillain shows up and, like, trashes everything, and Ollie's like, forget this, I'm leaving Seattle, and I'm just gonna go on the road. It really was kind of a swift kick in the nuts for longtime fans, because right off the bat, DC is basically making it very clear that they're chucking everything that Grell had set up. They want readers to know right away that it's being firmly reestablished in the DC universe with superheroes and supervillains and superpowers and costumes and all that stuff. And that comes at the expense of pretty much everything that Grell had been doing. I have a lot of problems with the way the series ended. The big one for me is that writers sort of took where Grell left off and used it as a jumping off point for a different version of Ollie than we had ever seen before. It became sort of part of the character that he is like this womanizer who sleeps around and can't be faithful to Dinah and all this stuff. And historically, that simply hasn't been true. Now, they have the excuse of crisis, and unfortunately, they have this jumping off point that Grell left them with where he finished off the character's romantic relationship with Dinah, left the door open. They basically ended up going in and adding all this stuff retconning it so that Ollie wasn't just sleeping with Marianne and Shadow while he was, you know, unconscious, but that he had actually been sleeping around, cheating on Dinah in years past, including the story that I mentioned in the last podcast in Flash 217 to 219, where he went to the monastery to sort of rediscover himself after he accidentally killed someone. They ended up retconning it so that he had an affair while he was at the monastery that eventually led to the birth of a son he never knew about, which became the new Green Arrow, Connor Hawk. I like Connor quite a bit, but basically Grell's decision to have Ollie leave Dinah in issue 75 in the way that he did, by sort of going behind her back with the younger woman, fundamentally changed how DC approached the character going forward. And it's not an approach that I cared for. It's just not how I have viewed Ollie. I don't think it's consistent with the way he had been portrayed up to that point. But again, I think it's a valid reading based on what Grell did. It's just not what I would have liked. Now, the irony here is that Grell had no intention of sticking with that status quo. In an interview he did later on, he detailed his plans for the series, what he was trying to set up before he was kicked off of the book. And basically what he said is that he had this idea that these kind of relationships are only interesting to the reader as long as there is a tension in them, a tension between the characters. So that if they ended up ever being happy together for a long period of time, it would become boring for the readers. Which is why he wanted to split the characters up every so often, such as when Ollie went on his soul searching, or prior to that he would have 4 or 6 issues in a row where he'd like go off to Alaska or to Japan or something, so that you would have this tension between the characters and then you'd have the excitement of them getting back together and sort of the drama of whether they will get back together. So what he was going to do here is he was just using this thing with Marianne as a way to break them up, get Ollie as a free agent. And then he was going to have Ollie actually have a sort of committed romantic relationship with Shadow, which is something that has not happened up to this point. There's a lot of stuff about them kind of being soulmates with, you know, the Way of the Bow and all this stuff. But, you know, they've never really explored that, and they haven't really had a chance to because Ollie was committed to Dinah the whole time. So what Grell wanted to do with the character is just explore that for a while. Explore how Ollie is with Shadow, how that relationship would work and how it wouldn't work, because he eventually was then planning on having Ollie realize, yep, you know, I still love Dinah. Dinah is, you know, my life partner. And then he was going to go back to Dinah. I think it was a mistake to have Ollie sleep with Marianne as part of this. I think that really opened the door for this new version of Ollie as a character. I certainly would have been interested to see Ollie in a relationship with Shadow and see how that went. As I mentioned, the last 20 issues or so of the series do feel pretty tired. So I can understand why DC wanted to change of pace. I'm guessing sales were slumping at that point. But it was kind of a frustrating, sudden, sad, and annoying end to what otherwise had been a really good run on Green Arrow. I think Longbow Hunters is a classic. I think the first 50 issues of the series still hold up, and I think it's one of the most important and interesting post-crisis reinventions that DC did. Now, after the end of the series, Grell ended up going on to do some creator-owned books like Shaman's Tears. He's never really sort of recaptured his glory days in a way. He still puts out good stuff, and his art is arguably better now than it's ever been. But his days as a sort of an A-list creator kind of came to an end with the end of Green Arrow. As for Ollie himself, the sort of new direction for Ollie didn't really take, and they killed him off with issue 101. They replaced him with Connor Hawk as the new Green Arrow, and Ollie remained dead for a number of years until he was finally brought back in a entertaining but really convoluted storyline written by Kevin Smith. Oddly enough, the one aspect of Grell's book that they decided to continue with after he left the series was actually the character of Eddie Fires. They jettisoned everything else, but Fires remained a supporting character and ended up becoming an unlikely mentor to Connor Hawk. So in a way, that's kind of a fitting thematic end for the Grell run, where Ollie had sort of slowly become more and more like Eddie. Ollie never did get to become the dad he wanted, but in a strange way, Eddie ended up becoming dad to Ollie's kid, which is a strangely fitting end to Mike Grell's run on Green Arrow. That's it for this episode of the Classic Comics Forum podcast. I hope you enjoyed this look at Mike Grell's Green Arrow. Please join us next time as Classic Comics Forum member Prince Hal will be joining me to discuss the critically acclaimed 1980s revival of DC's Blackhawk. And as always, visit us online at classiccomics.org to join in the conversation.